guy who may have read Shakespeare's sonnets and may be familiar with various philosophical traditions, but they've never had that type of human interaction. Going back to Israel, so when I say rabbinic training, certainly a certain degree of familiarity with secular culture and secular ideas would be helpful, but it doesn't necessarily mean that every rabbi has to go to college. I don't think that this idea that if rabbis go to college, they're going to be better rabbis necessarily is the case. I think that there has to be a system, though, which will allow for a greater degree of exposure, of empathy, of appreciation for how people who are unlike me are and yet want to have an entree into religion. It could be the Chabad model. It could be the YU model, but I don't think that's necessarily the one. But there has to be some sensitizing. There has to be some expansion of awareness. And I think that that is something that's definitely missing in the Israeli rabbinate.
Yeah, I mean, is it even a goal is my deeper question. In other words, does a rabbi of the Rabbanut see himself as responsible for the welfare in many different dimensions, not just the halachic, but the personal dimensions of the lives of the people in his care? And let's not take someone that's the Rav Rashi of a large city, but Rav Hashichun, some local, someone who's appointed for a neighborhood, let's say. Now that's a little bit more manageable. It is still diverse, but do they even have the sense that they're responsible for the, spiritual, emotional, personal welfare of the people in their community, or have they retreated completely to a bureaucratic function? And of course, I'm setting this up to talk about then this new Israel rabbinate model, whether from Tzohar, or from Itim, or other individuals who are trying a new model, or Rabiskin himself. In other words, is addressing this issue. The old model of a Rav was not just a posek. He's a posek, but you look at the Shaios and Tshuvos. He's also someone intimately involved in the lives of the people in his town. That old model is lost now in Israel, it seems to me. Maybe we could tighten this up a little bit and make it a little more accurate. It's not even a goal anymore. Or if it was, they've given up on it, or if it never was. And is there a new approach that's developing in Israel today? That's really one of the things.
Very quickly, I would say that it's all individual based. That it's not something that is muvan meilav. It's not something that is assumed. That this idea of the rabbi as the shepherd of his kehilah. I think that there's no question that the primary function, the function which a rabbi has to fulfill is the bureaucratic function. If you're in charge of the Eruv, you have to make sure the Eruv is up. If you're in charge of Kashrut, then you have to make sure that Kashrut is done. If you're in charge of registering marriages, then you spend. Now, we can belittle that, and there are good reasons for belittling that, but again, think about the numbers here. Think about so what I'm saying is that it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that a rabbi is purely a bureaucrat. But the possibility of, think about a teacher, okay? A teacher who is very empathic and very loving and very nurturing to their student in the first grade will be appreciated by the parents all year until at the end of the year they realize that their children didn't learn how to read, right? Because their primary function is still to make sure that the children learn how to read. So if you have these rabbis, if they don't do their job, meaning keeping the kashrut, or they don't keep the I don't want to fault people. Sometimes there are people who are just lazy or are malicious or are just grubby about money. But I think that the bureaucratic aspects of it are very demanding. So a person to do more than that would have to be very committed and would have to be naturally disposed to those things. And yes, there are efforts being made to offer alternatives, and I think that those efforts reflect the fact that there is there's a disconnect. Reflect the fact that the rabbinate has not succeeded in endearing religion the Lashon HaMa'ata in the least bit to the Israeli public. But I do want to say that I don't think that even if the rabbinate is unbelievably successful, that you're going to revolutionize Israeli society. I don't think all of a sudden we're going to have, if we have the most, you know, there are limits to rabbis too. I don't want to overstate what rabbis can do. I think they can make it better. I think that they can offer more. But I don't think that they can, I think that the rabbi in the communal model in America has more, much more hashba'a on a spiritual life. So if you want to, I could talk a little bit about some of these models, which...
I wanted to push the question a little bit differently.
Sure.
So where do the Orthodox Jews find... I mean, I think it's fascinating the point of the problem of scale, that you're dealing with rabbis, you know, rabbis dealing with 20,000 people is not reasonable to expect the same as rabbis 400. And one of the issues is, ironically, you know, people... You know, Rabbi Lamb used to tell us, right, the one thing Israel isn't short of is rabbis. But right, everyone should make Aliyah except for rabbis, right, is what he used to tell us. Because Israel has enough of them.
That's why I became an academic, because I, you know, it wouldn't be fair to
come around. There's an interesting question of whether, you know, whether Israel actually needs a much higher rabbi to individual ratio than it has right now. And, you know, and we actually haven't thought about it, that really to have the same relationship of rabbis. If we had the same percentage of rabbis who had responsibilities in Israel, it would be, you know, like the number of lawyers in America.
Right? You know, there are too many lawyers in Israel, too.
America has like a percentage of lawyer to human population of about 4 to 5 to 1 greater than any other country in the world, I think.
Is it more than Israel?
I think so. But I'm interested in, so where does the Orthodox community get its leadership? It doesn't sound to me like the rabbinate has any right really has any relationship with the Orthodox Jews either, in that sense. And so one of the issues that interests me, right, is so let's say when we see the controversies about statements put out by right community rabbis and things like that, does anybody care? Right, if you wanted to affect the ideological content of the Israeli Orthodox community, and let's even leave out the Haredi, right? You want to leave out the Israeli Dati Lumi community. So who has that kind of impact, and how do they have it?
Okay, that's wonderful. So I think that you do have situations like this where I talked about constituencies and conflicting constituencies. So you will have a situation where you have a rabbi of a town or of a shchuna of a neighborhood where their relationship to the non-observant constituency is purely bureaucratic, but because their natural constituency is the Orthodox community, that there they will be more nurturing, and there they will function because you know they're the people who really care about things, and there they'll really they'll give a shiur. And who's going to come if I give a daf yomi shiur? If I give a weekly or biweekly shiur, who's going to come? So for those anshei shlomenu, for those people who are part of then there'll be a close relationship. That's not going to help in terms of changing Israel's society, but it is a bifurcation in an interesting way. But the broader point that Rabbi Klapper brought up here, where do Orthodox Jews in Israel look for leadership? So I think that it's either sort of star personalities or your teachers, meaning your Rosh Yeshiva, or your high school Rosh Yeshiva, or your Hesder Rosh Yeshiva, or your head of your Mechina. There are some very charismatic, or very competent, or very knowledgeable, or very influential figures within the religious Zionist world. But most of them are... connected and function within the elite, within elite institutions. Within those elite institutions, I mean, if you learn in Yeshivat Har Etzion, then Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is a very influential figure for you. And so is Rav Yaakov Meidan, and so was Rav Amital Zichrono Livracha. These were people who I learned there, were people who you look to as role models, as people who could help you develop your worldview, similar to people in America who went to Yeshiva University, or studied, or went to go to Chofevei Torah, or go to you know, that's those, these are people who develop you know, these are people who set a vision for people. So those, there are Roshei Yeshiva. I have three post high school sons. Each one of them is, I'm very happy that each one of them picked a different Hester Yeshiva to learn. And I'm proud that each of them chose to be in Hester Yeshiva, because I believe in serving in the army, and I and the combination between serving in the army and learning Torah is something that I'm pleased to see that they've internalized. But I'm also really glad that they each chose a different yeshiva. I have a son who's in the fifth year in Gush. I have a son who's in the second year in Otniel. I don't know if any of you have heard of Otniel. Otniel is sort of a very serious learning yeshiva, but it has a real Hasidish element to it, sort of neo-Hasidic element to it, and that fits my son's personality. I went there for Yom Kippur, and you know, there's the Midrash, or it's a Gemara that says about Yom Kippur that it's Kippurim Taminu li, believe me, there was more joy on that Yom Kippur in that Otniel than any Purim party I've been to in the last 30 years. And then I have a son who learns in Yeshivat HaGolan, in Chispin, in Ramat HaGolan. Each of those yeshivas, you know, for the outsider, they all look the same, you know, knitted kippahs, this and that. But for the people who are inside, they see each one of them has a different hashkafa, a different worldview. And but I see what long term, what will happen is each of my sons will look to their Rosh Yeshiva as their as the people who sort of are the models of their religious view. So I think that in today's Israeli religious Zionist society, many adults have studied, certainly on a high school level, and a lot of them have also gone to advanced yeshivot, and certainly their children, just like it actually caught on after America. I don't know if anyone's really written this or paid attention to this. You know, it went a little bit before I went, this whole phenomenon of the year in Israel, right? Yeah. You know, the post-high school year in Israel started to pick up. BMT, I think there was BMT, Karim Biavne, and Gush, you know, that was the first ones, and then it started to pick up. And today there are, like, you know, so many institutions for boys and girls, and it's in many, I don't know if it's like, let's say in Maimonides, is it sort of expected that the kids will go to Israel for the year? So Israel sort of it copied the American system. It's really interesting. Everyone knows there were these Hester yeshivas with this 5-year program, but those are elitist institutions. Those were only for kids who were really into learning. But about 20 years ago, there was a new type of institution which was started. It's called a Mechina Kedam Tzvait, which is a 1-year program, which is focused on preparing kids for the army, both in order to be strong enough to, within the army, maintain their religious commitment, but also sort of to hypercharge them into being super committed, some people would say a sort of a militaristic type of religion, so that when they go into army, you know, if you look at the paratroopers or Golani or Givati or Kfir, you'll see that there's a very, very high percentage of religious officers today. The reason is because of this mechinot, where there's such a focus on doing serious crack unit service. But in terms of our, I think that's a very interesting discussion. It's something that really is worth understanding in terms of changes in Israeli society and in the role of religion, because within the army, and that's why secular people are scared out of their mind, you know, just like in Turkey, you know, they're worried about the Islamicists taking over the army. They should have worried about the Islamicists taking over the presidency, but they were focused on the army. But in Israel, people are really worried. You know, this whole thing that happened with the disengagement from Gaza, and this question of whether soldiers would be misarev pukuda, whether they would not listen to the orders of their officers, and they would listen to their rabbis, right? So this is a fear that these rabbis have more influence on the students than the than the government and the army, and that, you know, that's a scary thing. But the point I wanted to make is that when my son, he went to a high school with 100 graduating kids in the graduating class, if 90% of them went to either a Hesder Yeshiva or to a Mechina, that means 90% of them now have a Rav. So those are the people who are influential. Those are the people who are making the
difference. That's a terrific answer, and we could talk at some other point about how that parallels the experience of whether rabbis are really the most influential figures in American Orthodox life. Synagogue rabbis as opposed to Rosh Yeshiva. So I want to ask one follow-up that we should really take, which is, so of those figures who are influential in American religious Zionism, how do they relate to the American self-conception of
Israeli religion?
Right, Israeli, right. How do they relate to the American self-conception of modern Orthodoxy? Right, you know, is this the community that American modern Orthodoxy wants to identify with? Right, is this, you know, if you were thinking about how modern Orthodoxy, where you send your kids to study Israeli yeshiva, right, who you support, all that, it sounds like that's the critical level. Which community is it? The community of, you know, let's talk about, to what degree is America built on autonomy, and this is right, and that's not a value to what the American modern Orthodoxy, to what degree is it built on valuation of the non-Jewish other, right? So, to what extent are those communities really parallel, and the leader, and particularly in the leadership?
Okay, good. No, I like the question, and I really do, Well, I mean, it's obvious to everybody that when you give your child up to any educational institution, you're in big trouble, right? Except sometimes they know how to educate our children better than we do, and it's good to recognize that. But, you know, that's a scary thing, right? I think that there are institutions that are closer to an American worldview, American modern Orthodox worldview, and there's a reason that a lot of, yeshivas like Gush or like Eretz HaTzvi or the Rabbi Riskin's institutions, probably they're not exactly like the modern Orthodox view, but a lot of the core values are similar, and that is a reason that certainly people who are of an intellectual bent, Often those children feel more comfortable there because there's not a denigration of secular studies, there's not a denigration of an integrative approach, and et cetera, et cetera. I just wrote an article actually about trips to Poland. And I actually wrote about trips to Poland for kids who were in Israel for the year. Mm-hmm. And what I suggested was that if the experience of the kid who goes to Israel for the year is this holistic experience where they're sort of totally taken away from their American environment and under the influence of rabbis who are not necessarily of the same wavelength as their parents and of the environments that they grew up in America. Al achat kama v'kama is the case when they're on an 8-day trip in Poland with these same rabbis, and it's much more intensive and much more the distinctions become even more clear. So the answer is that there are many Israeli institutions which are, if we are strong Zionists in the sense that we believe strongly in Israel as part of our, you know, religious conscience or part of our religious values, and believe that that's part of what it means to be an observant Jew today, that they certainly fulfill those criteria. But in many other areas, they would be much closer to what would be considered a Haredi worldview in terms of attitudes towards secular education, in terms of concepts of diversity, in terms of questions of, you know, the whole issues of questioning, of an open-mindedness, of value, attitudes towards the other, whether, you know, particularly the non-Jewish other. Towards the whole issue of what is the role that religion plays within our lives. And I think this is one of the reasons I said this actually in Brookline today, and I think it's worth repeating. It's not across the board But you'll notice that of the kids who, you know, there's this word flip. You ever hear that word? Yeah. Flipping out, right? So there's this book that just came out. It's not exactly accurate, but, you know, of kids who get very inspired during their year or 2 years in Israel, young women and young men, you will notice that a high percentage of them are the ones who make Aliyah because they become very inspired with Israel. And there's also a high percentage that move towards a more rigid type of religious Jewish life here in America and become more, you know, Haredization, more towards the right. So it seems to me that what a lot of people take out of their year or two in Israel is they want Judaism to be the totality of their existence. They want Judaism to be something which is not bifurcated, where it's in the synagogue or in the home, or, you know, they want it to be something that they live all the time. And for those young people, whether it's conscious or not, the two choices are moving to Israel. Because if you move to Israel, even if I'm more liberal, more, you know, then I'm living a holistic Jewish existence because it's a Jewish society. Or becoming Haredi. Because the only way to live a holistic Jewish existence in America is to be Haredi. That's the assumption. I don't think that that's necessarily true, but that seems to be the best way to do it. So getting back to the institutions that people are learning in, I think that there are quite a few institutions, not all, but there are quite a few institutions that would lend themselves to that sort of approach. You know, Israeli institutions know that they have to be able to recruit from America, and therefore they can't go overboard because they have, you know, they have to answer to principals, they have to answer to YU, they have to answer to all sorts of institutions. And yet, there is no question that the fact that someone is a religious Zionist does mean that there's a certain appreciation for aspects of modern life. But it is not this, like, idealized modern orthodoxy, which, by the way, you know, if you'll ask Chaim Waxman, a very important sociologist, ask him, you know, how many people outside of Sharon, Newton, Brookline, Riverdale, Teaneck, Berkeley, you know, in this... So we're so-called modern Orthodox in their lifestyle really care about these meeting of ideas. But, you know, he'd say it's like, you know, it's very small, and that, you know, that's a challenge, and that's a question. Maybe that's a failure of educators. I don't know, or maybe most people are just bogged down with economics or just getting through life. So yes, I think that many Israeli institutions would not fall into the chachila categories of modern orthodoxy, but if you, let's say, travel around New York, for example, many day schools or high schools which would be called modern orthodox, you'll see most of the teachers in those schools are Haredi, and you would see that the Limudei Kodesh they're being taught are more on Haredi. So I don't think it's only an Israeli phenomenon, but there's certainly an Israeli aspect to it.
We should take questions.
So it seems like from my observations, my Israeli friends, that their social communal identity is formed through affiliation with youth groups, like B'nai Akiva and Ariel are big ones. And then as they grow older, it's their Rosh Yeshiva that they are they're getting, you know, that they look to them as the head of their community, and even if they did Hezer in one place and then they live somewhere else, they still consider their yeshiva as their center. And even just small things like the Shabbat periodicals that they give out there are very, in the shuls, are very politicized and very much in line with identification of a certain group. So I'm just wondering, what is the difference between, first of all, what's the impact of these youth movements? How do they change things? And second, where you have communal rabbis in America as the ones who are talking about giving psak and giving lifestyle advice and everything versus Rosh Yeshiva, where you know, they're very different environments, and they're very different types of rabbis from my own observations of who would be a community rabbi and who's a yeshiva rabbi. So how does that affect the greater community?
Okay. I think I'm going to focus more on the first question than the second one. But I do want to say something first or second, just briefly about the second thing. There is one other category that I don't know if you're aware of, and it's kind of cute, but it's interesting in terms of thinking about the difference between America and Israel. Has anyone ever heard of SMS shoot? Okay, this is an amazing phenomenon. SMS means texting. So there's this one Parshat HaShavua journal called Kippah, I think, which comes out every week. That you know, most shuls you can pick it up. In Israeli shuls, there are about like 25 of these alonim that you can pick up on the Parshat HaShavua from every, you know, political, ideological, you know, feminist, peace, anti-feminist, Chabad, Mashiach Chabad, Deist Chabad, you know, every possibility, So there's this one where every week on the front thing they have about 25 questions, which were answered by Rav Aviner and Rav Shmuel Eliyahu, who was the one who sponsored that that psak, where people send texts, you know. So sometimes we say, you know, it'll be an interesting thing, you know, someone's on a bus and they want to know, you know, if it's going to be shkia, could they say, you know, mincha standing on a bus? It's kind of interesting, you know, that we're in a day where you can actually get an answer, instant answer, you know, and different, you know, how sock has changed. But sometimes I will say, like, you know, you'll see this thing, you know, why did God allow the Holocaust to happen? The answer is, you know, because, you know, so-and-so, and there'll be a one-line answer. It's like, gee, that's an abuse of halacha, and that's, you know, where that's really cheapening of the whole thing. But, so that, next time you're in Israel, pick, or you could probably see them online, too. That's just that whole way of communicating halacha. I think youth groups are the greatest thing that Israel has. One of the greatest things. All my kids have grown up in Bnei Akiva. I sometimes have problems with how Bnei Akiva has become like more. You know, sometimes there's like pressure to be more segregated, guys and girls. I think it's most Israeli kids go to separate schools, so I think it's a great thing that once a week they meet in Bnei Akiva. It's a very healthy environment. I think, you know, that's just my way of looking. I think that, you know, controlled and positive socializing within a good environment is good for kids. It's natural. I don't think it's negative. You know, sometimes it causes social pressures, but it seems to be a good thing. I think kids get so much out of youth groups. I think that the snif, you know, the building where it's like, just imagine you have this shul but it's only for kids. You know, they play community. They take responsibility. By the time they're in 10th grade, they're already madrichim. There's a, you know, it's their society. And like once a year on Shabbat Irgun, they invite the parents to come see. Other than that, you don't step foot in there. It's their place. And Israeli kids are much more independent than American kids. They're much more doing things on their own, and I think that youth groups certainly promoted. I can tell you, in terms of our own personal experience. So our son, one of our children, we have four boys and two girls. So our second son, after 11th grade, he had gone to the same yeshiva tichonit from 7th grade, and by 11th grade, he was kind of tired of that school, and they were kind of tired of him. You know, he could have continued, but we just didn't think that, you know, 12th grade for a lot of kids is a hard time. You know, you're already on your way out, and it could sort of be an environment which wouldn't cause positive educational development. And the most amazing thing happened. Bnei Akiva has a program called Shelef. Shelef is, it's Shministim Le'ayarot Periferia. Shministim is the Israeli slang for 12th graders. And what they do is they take five boys or five girls and they send them to an outlying city. In my son's case, this is a 17-year-old. Five 17-year-olds live together in a house by themselves in Sderot. During the Gaza War, my son was living in Sderot and, you know, it's kind of scary. They did their 12th grade in the local religious school in Sderot, where it's a much weaker religious environment and the educational. You know, I remember when my son came home for Sukkot and my brother was with us and he said, Yoel, how's it going? And he said, oh, it's amazing. The people are amazing. They're very warm. They're from North African backgrounds. They're very warm, very inviting. The kids are great. They're very, you know, it's wonderful. And, you know, it's really good for me religiously because I have to be a role model. So I think that youth groups, sometimes they can like lischov, they can pull people in, you know, get people overly enthusiastic. For the most part, I think it's empowering. I think that it was the things that I remember as being the most positive experiences that I had as a youth religiously were things to do with like Yeshiva University seminars and these very, you know, open-ended conversations and singing and something that was, you know, fun, happy Judaism with a social aspect. And I think that Israeli kids have a lot more of that than in America. And, America, most of kids' religious life beyond home is their school, if they go to a day school. And it's still school. So no matter how fun you can be, I went to SAR in Riverdale, if you're familiar with it. That's like the funnest school around. And it was still school. So I think it would be good if American Jewry could actually come up with broad, you know, Camp Moshava is a wonderful thing. All of our kids, we send them after 12th grade to be counselors in Camp Moshava in Io. And I'll never forget when our oldest son came back from a summer in Moshava and he said to me, Abba, giliti mazat zionut. You know, I discovered what is Zionism by going to Pennsylvania.
I have a question. Speaking of modern orthodoxy, I just recently read about this book. I can't remember what it was, where the rabbi was arrested for fomenting heat and whatever, and the idea of the sefer had to do with the issue of whether, if you're in the army, you could obey, the orders, and also had to do with under which conditions you could kill civilian population. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but to my mind, if we don't pay attention to sort of the drift and wonder if that's where we're going,
Certainly there are dangerous people out there who use Torah knowledge in a dangerous way, but I don't think that's new. I mean, I think, we all are familiar with Meir Kahana. The issue is if they're countered. I think if people just let these, books be published and no one writes a book that gives an alternative, let's say, If we take something that I expected to come up here, this Psikat Halakha recently about not selling land to non-Jews, which has stirred up a lot of controversy in certain ways, I think, among American Jews more than within Israel for a variety of reasons. I think that the best thing that came out of it is that Rav Lichtenstein felt that he had to write a letter counter and that some of the Sohar rabbis had to write letters and that other people had to. But I think there are always going to be crazies and there are always going to be smart crazies. But if you let them take the agenda and you let them have the stage and nobody offers an alternative, that's the problem. But, you're never going to be able to do
so. Was that counted effectively?
Well, I think a book just came out actually.
Derech HaMelech came out against Torah HaMelech, and it's a very effective counter. And many little articles have come out against it too.
Rav Meidan spoke very strongly against it.
Right. Also, right. And educators, even if you don't write books, educators have to know what their students are reading and have to be able to, get up there and voice opinions. And you hope that the educators are responsible people. I remember as a student in yeshiva, I was studying in yeshiva when they had the whole machteret, the whole Jewish underground in 1983, where they were setting bombs under the cars of Arab mayors, and I was learning in Gush, and I remember very, very clearly Rav Lichtenstein getting up and giving a very, very, very emotional and very intensive talk about why these acts were against our values as Torah Jews. And I remember that, having a very strong impression on me. So, yes, that's a very important thing. Yeah.
So we talk about the different, we talk about Israeli society, but we then talk the sub-societies, secular society, Latin Orthodox society, Haredi society, as if they're really distinct and they don't have influence one another. But is there a dynamic in which there's influence, at least on the edges, that may sort of temper some of the concerns about one group or another going off the wagon, so to speak?
I think as much as we might look at it as being something negative, I think the political system has some advantages to it because the Israeli political system is predicated on compromise. There has to be, you might denigrate the fact that the Haredim want money for their institutions, and you might denigrate the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu just wants to stay in power, and you might denigrate the fact that people who are settlement is the most important thing for them will dedicate themselves just to getting money for settlements. But no one's going to get their whole piece of the pie, and because they all have to live together and they all have an interest in continuing to function, so that actually allows for a level of conversation that's sometimes combative, but it's usually just around election times. Other than around election time, actually, everyone gets along very well. There was a great story a couple of weeks ago where there was a party for the retiring spokesman for, I think the main press spokesman. And at this party, he invited all the different people he'd been working with, the representative of the settlers in Hebron, representative of Haredi parties, etc., the representative of Shalom Achshav, and some journalist was there and took a picture of the head of Shalom Achshav hugging Noam, what's his name? Noam, I forgot his name, who's the spokesman for the Jews of Hebron. And that became like tremendous controversy in Shalom Achshav. How can you hug the guy from Hebron? They're our enemies. So, he, after initially, he said, well, but he's still a human being, and, we still, have to work sort of in the same environment. Afterwards, he said, well, the fact that I gave a hug to this person from, I don't know what he said, like Lily Kut or something, that was okay. But you're right, the people from Hebron, they're really, our enemies. I shouldn't have hugged him. And, and he wrote a letter of apology. This is just interesting about, what's in the news, Right. So actually, I think the political system sometimes is a good vehicle for overlap.
For the average individual, on a day-to-day basis, is enough in families, that socially, that... Are these communities either fortunately or unfortunately isolated from one another, except for these politics, which obviously jealousy involves the politicians on a personal basis?
You could certainly, other than for your job, live a very, very isolated life. If you're religious and you live in a community, if you live in a yeshuv in Yudah and Shomron, in a religious yeshuv, and you work well if you're a teacher or something, you work in a religious environment, or if you work in computers, and you go, and so you have like very, very minimal, very basic interactions with. So yeah, you could really avoid, but that's a choice you made. I know my wife and I chose specifically to live in a place like Kfar Saba because we didn't want that. We wanted to live as part of all of Israeli society. So I think it's very individual, but I think you're sort of what you're pointing out is that many people like to live where they're comfortable, and in Israel, as opposed to in America, well, I don't know. In New York, you can live almost like that too. If you live in the five towns in New York, you could probably never really interact with anyone in a meaningful manner who is not Jewish or not religious beyond going to the store, maybe in Teaneck as well. I don't know if that's possible in Sharon or in Newton or in Brookline. Meaningful relationships. I don't mean just going to the post office. I don't mean just tipping your garbage man before Christmas. I mean really interacting. I think people should ask themselves. I think generally people like to be with the people they like. But in Israel, maybe it's easier to do that. In Israel, people can barricade themselves more.
In America, we tend to assume that religious Zionism and modern Orthodoxy are either the same category or one subcategory. But is that now in Israel a miscategory, a confusion of categories?
There's an over.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think it depends how you look at modern Orthodoxy. That's really what comes down to. I think that there is a tendency among a certain group within American Orthodoxy, and again, I sort of pointed out to the fact that I think it's not such a big group, to intellectualize their Judaism, and that type of intellectualization of Judaism exists in America, in Israel, but much less so. And it's something that is unique to certain communities in America, and I could probably list them. And then there are individuals outside those communities. I guess there are enough to publish books, and people buy those books. But it's a very small sector. But if you look at the idea, the principal idea being what was begun really with Shimshon Falhirsch, which is Torah-im. So Shimshon Falhirsch, he said, Torah im Derech Eretz. He took the Mishnah from Pirkei Avot, and he said that Derech Eretz doesn't mean how you behave. It doesn't mean getting a parnasa. Derech Eretz means general culture. Well, that was the first positive statement by an Orthodox traditional rabbi who comes along and says that we feel l'chadchila, that's the way you should do it. You have to have a synthetic type of religious life. So then, now, other people didn't agree that it's Torah im derech eretz and general culture, but they said Torah umada, right? Y-U, Torah umada. Mada meaning secular knowledge, which has a wide variety of interpretations. But then there are other people who said, no, we want to be... we want to settle the land, and we believe that that's an interaction between Torah, and they called it Torah ve'avodah, B'nai Akiva, the religious kibbutz movement. So what I'm trying to say is that what all these institutions have, phenomena is not necessarily the same intellectual bent, nor all the same values, but they're all predicated on a principle which is not accepted in the Haredi world, that there is something beyond Torah, and that something beyond Torah enhances Torah, and that living a full Jewish life in contemporary times means finding a way to interface between Torah, or to integrate between Torah and seemingly outside values. So I think on that level, religious Zionism and modern Orthodoxy are in conversation in a way that American Orthodoxy and the Haredi world are not. It might not always come out in practical things, and there are all sorts of hybrids. Like, anyone here read Chakira? This is this interesting magazine. I knew you read it, right? You know, I think it's like half the people who are involved in that are Haredi, and half of them are modern Orthodox, and they all live in Flatbush, right? Flatbush is an interesting place. And they got together and produced this really interesting magazine, which has very thoughtful articles, because it turns out that there are people who feel most comfortable socially and primarily in terms of educating their children being in the Haredi world, but intellectually they're actually much broader than that, and therefore they, at least for themselves, they want to have a vehicle for interacting. And people make choices about the education of their children, not necessarily because it's what they totally believe in, it's because they think it's the best bet for the long term. The kids will learn the most Torah, or the kids will have the least chance of assimilating, or the children... Okay, but getting back to your point, so they're not the same thing, but I don't think that means that there is not a particular affinity between them that is worth cultivating. I don't think that we should just dismiss them as two things that certain won't meet. I think they do meet in meaningful ways. I just want to say one more thing about it. I think it's important to understand, and I think we do, but I want to emphasize the most important factor for Israelis growing up, religious Israelis, it's not whether you study secular knowledge. It's not, it's whether you do the army. That's it. Okay? Bottom line, whether you do the army or not is the separation point. Now, there are Haredi people who do the army later on, and so, but that's it in Israel. So that on that level, Israel is in a totally different place. The role of the army, the role of the decision of whether you believe at an early age in your life you should be putting your life on the line for the defense of the state of Israel is something which distinguishes in a very, very clear way between someone who is affiliated with the religious Zionist camp and someone who is more associated with the Haredi world. But it's also a way in which Israelis in general and Israeli religious Zionists are so distant from their American counterparts. And I remember my son, who grew up traveling to America and is very exposed and intellectually actually, sort of resonates to a lot of things we've been talking about. He's telling me about that feeling when he learned in Gush and he got friendly with some of the Americans that, and some of them stayed, he came Shir Aleph and they stayed Shir Bet. And then, at the end of the second year, they all went to college and he went to Tironut, to basic training. And just that sense of how different we are. And it was so powerful for him. They'd learned in the same base medrash. They had been in the same conversation. Some of them knew Hebrew really well. And at that moment, and it's not about intellectual, it's about this one issue. And I think it's very important for us to recognize how essential that is.
So picking up on that, the question is broader Israeli society. You spoke before about the concern or fear that a lot of Israelis have about the extent to which the leadership and the cadre of the elite units was made of religious observant kids. What is the other side? What are the secular folks doing about the fact that so many of their kids don't go to the army? That they avoid army duty? Are they responding in a positive way by trying to get the kid? I mean, rather than tear down the religious strains as Yuli Tal from the prior education ministry tried to do, are there some positive
responses from
their side about encouraging feelings of Zionism or a commitment to?
I think those are two different things. I think, I'm glad you said that at the end. I think most Israeli kids go to the army. I don't think it's really, maybe it's a little higher than it was in the past. It's not very high. The highest percentage of kids in the city with the highest percentage of enlisted, kids in the army is Kfar Saba. The kids with the most combat soldiers is Ra'anana. These are secular cities. And the highest percentage of officers in the Israeli army still come from, not from kibbutzim and moshavim, and the highest percentage of pilots still come from the issue that you're sort of referring to is more in terms of like the Tel Aviv area.
Yeah,
and within the Tel Aviv area, they go to the army, but they prefer to go to what's called Shmoneh Matayim. Anyone know what Shmoneh Matayim is? Shmoneh Matayim is this very big unit, but it's the known, it's like the Israel high tech. Israel high tech is so powerful today for two reasons. Because of Shmoneh Matayim, because all these kids at a very young age are trained in very sophisticated electronics and computer things for intelligence, because of Russian Aliyah. Think about 1990, from 1990, almost a million very educated, many of them came to Israel and what that's done. And people should be aware of that Aliyah isn't just about who is a Jew. That's what people talk about today. It's also about Israeli empowerment and why Israeli economy is so robust today and why Israel, that Aliyah really was so crucial. I think there is concern. I think something like the fact that Israeli high school kids go to Poland is like an effort to sort of say, well, maybe last ditch, you know, Zionism doesn't work, maybe Holocaust will work, you know, and that's pretty pathetic, but it's not the only place in the world where Holocaust is used as last ditch Jewish education. And there are efforts being made. One of the interesting efforts, I mentioned the Mechinot Kdam Tzvayot, there are lots of secular Mechinot now. There are secular religious ones, and there are also secular Mechinot. We're trying to create like a yeshiva for a year before you go to the army. And I remember my son told me when he was in the army, when he was in commander's school, he said the kids that he had the most, besides his friends from yeshiva, that he enjoyed spending time with the most were the kids who were, he had either gone to these mechinot, or they are kibbutznikim, who they do what's called shnat sherut, or kids who go to Israeli secular youth movements, who before they go to the army, they spend a year in a development town or a year in a kibbutz or a year doing something productive. And he said, those are the kind of kids, you know, they're secular and they're very different from me in terms of their lifestyle, but we're in conversation because we're given a values-laden education. So yes, I think that there are people in Israeli society who are very concerned, but I don't think it's just about the kids. I think if you ask me what is most is a scary word, but one of the most terrifying things or the things that are most difficult in looking at Israeli society today, it's not religious secular conflict, it's materialism. It's just the, you know, some would call it, you know, copying American capitalism. I don't know if it's copying America. I think it's just the idea of the focus on being careerist and the idea of focus on that the role models are the sharks, they call them, the people who have made the big bucks, who have, you know, sold their companies, who have invested, who have, you know, the oligarchs, et cetera. And I think that is a very, very, very big societal problem. And that cuts across the board, even to Haredi society, where, you know, across the board, there's more focus on material and less focus on values and idealism. Maybe the religious community is doing a better job right now of neutralizing that. But I don't think that it's, it exists within the religious community too. And the secular community, it exists in a big way. Can I make a little summary statement? Are we saying this? So first of all, I really enjoy this. I hope it was enjoyable for you, but for me, the opportunity, I like to hear more in many ways, but the opportunity to meet with people who, I connect to in a very visceral way, sometimes more, you know, I feel foreign in Israel often, but at the same time, I always feel foreign here. So it's important for me, and it gives me a sense of the pulse of Jewish life, and also professionally because of what I do and because of what I write about, that, you know, I don't want to call you guinea pigs, but, you know, okay. But I do want to say something that I believe in very strongly. And we'll offer it as a thought. You know, I've lived in Israel a long time, and I have a lot of students and a lot of people, and I speak a lot in the United States, and I thank God I get invited in the United States, and I've taught in China, throughout Europe, and inevitably a lot of people say, you know, why did you make Aliyah? And this is not an Aliyah speech, and I'm not into that. That's not where I'm at. But I think it's relevant to this conversation. So, you know, why do you make Aliyah? So so one possibility, oh, he's a religious Jew, he's a rabbi, you know, so it's a mitzvah, right? You know? I definitely can't say that. I think there are a lot of mitzvot. I think that there are many people who are doing lots of very important mitzvot here, and certainly, you know, if someone wanted to go into chinuch, and, you know, there are certainly many, many reasons why one would be more successful in an environment which is familiar to them than going to a foreign environment. I couldn't say that it's because, you know, I have this sort of obsession with land and with that sort of, I mean, I do feel very strongly about it. I like the fact that, you know, when I, you know, walk around in Hanukkah, it's like Israeli Christmas, you know, but the fact is all the decorations are Jewish ones. It's only on Sukkot where you see the Christmas decorations in Israel. Because all the, you know, all the used ones from China, they come to Israel and they put them up in the Sukkot. It's interesting. But the answer that I give you know, the answer that I give, and I think that Israel is the great experiment in Jewish history. You know, it might seem cliche-ish to say that our grandparents or great-grandparents couldn't even imagine, but the fact is, this is something new. It's only, you know, 62 years old. It's really complicated. There are a lot of problems. There are a lot of tensions. There are a lot of things that are dissatisfying for us. There are a lot of reasons one could say, I don't want to be a part of that. There are a lot of reasons to think that, you know, in the sort of pristine type of Judaism that some that we are able to live or privileged to live sometimes in certain communities in America, that seems much cleaner, much less, you know, dirty, much less sullied. But the great experiment in Jewish history is going on right now in the state of Israel. And at least on a personal level, the opportunity to be a part of that experiment, to be a little, even a little bit of a player, or to through creating a family there and being a part of a community and a part of a university and a part of a, you know, of various societies, to me that's very invigorating. It's sometimes very frustrating. It's sometimes just it hurts, and it's sometimes, you know, but it's passionate and it's alive and it's dynamic and it's very real, and to me, I think that was very appealing, and as I grow older, it remains very very appealing. So I part of what appeals to me about that is because it doesn't brush over all the problems. It doesn't say that we're, you know, I'm not the Sochnut HaYehudit coming to sell you Israel. I'm not trying to tell you. Now, I'm aware, I even spend some of my time analyzing those problems getting into the kishkas, the depths of those problems. But the very sense of living in that laboratory and being a part of an experiment in process, at least for me, with even the possibility that the experiment will fail. And I'm aware of that. You know, I'm a historian. I'm aware of that possibility. But just being part of that experiment is fulfilling, and it's certainly exciting. It certainly it produces a very full life, and I think also a very full and a very experientially diverse and rich Jewish life. And I think that's something that we always have to think about when we think about the problems and the difficulties and the frustrations of looking at Israeli society. And I'm not being apologetic. I think that's just part of the balance of the totality that we have to be aware of. So I want to thank you very much for your time.
Yeah,
and appreciate
thank Dr. Fursi for a very stimulating conversation, and that last wrap-up was profound. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to everybody for coming out tonight. Really, a very stimulating conversation. Thank you.